St. Helens remained unconscious. A movement at ground level took her attention. Two horsemen were there astride their steeds, looking up.
There he is, Quarry. How are we going to get him down?
Don't ask me, Bermode. We're going to need some help. Look over there.
What?
His daughter. How'd she get over there?
Oh, I don't know. What's that shine?
A sword. Must be St. Helens. You up there, girl. You hurt?
No, but my father is...
You climb on down. Bring the sword.
Helen started down without the sword.
Bring the sword, I said!
There was no helping it. She was largely helpless, with or without the sword, and would only make things worse if she tried to defy these rough men. She reached up with the left gauntlet and took up the sword, as if it belonged in that hand. As she drew it down to her lower level, she saw that there was an inscription on the blade that she hadn't observed before. Her eyes read it without conscious effort.
Given an eternal friendship from His Majesty Philip Blastmore, King of Aretex.
Now what did that mean? Had St. Helens stolen the sword, or had he and the king really been friends?
Come on, hurry it up!
Look at those legs!
She had forgotten what she was wearing. This silken dress exposed everything from below. But what could she do? If she tried to stay up in the tree, they would fire a crossbow bolt into her. She gritted her teeth and continued climbing down. Sooner than she had expected, the right gauntlet swung her out on a limb and dropped her the short remaining distance. The men stood as if mesmerized, their eyes round, their mouths open. Because of her legs? In other circumstances, she would have taken that as a compliment. As it was, she was disgusted, but didn't dare say so.
You see that, Corey? She must be part Hookat. I thought she'd fall.
That would have been a waste.
Bring me that sword, woman.
Help my father.
We'll help him when we get help. We've got the chains all ready for him, haven't we, Corey?
Helen saw that there was a length of heavy chain fastened to Bemode's saddle. As she watched, he unfastened it, and the chain dropped to the ground.
You are going to chain my father?
Have to. King's orders. But maybe not the same for you if you cooperate. Your sword?
Don't be rough, Bemode. The king wouldn't like it. He doesn't want it badly marked. Worse yet, Melba wouldn't like it.
Melba's not gonna get it.
Still?
Pity. Still, we can make her say it's all right. Then...
The sword and the gauntlet lifted without Helen quite willing it. A sudden determination came to her. Bemode reached out to take the sword.
Give me that!
No!
The sword darted at Bemode's face, pulling back before touching it.
Well, I'll be a cuckold!
Bemode whipped out his own blade and made a swipe with it. As he did, the gauntlet fainted, twisted her wrist, and Bemode's blade rebounded. Not only rebounded, but flew away with great force. Corey reached for the sword sheathed at his hip. He paused, eyeing the tip of Helen's blade that was suddenly at his throat.
You! Get that chain and drag it to this tree!
Bemode did as instructed, looking worriedly at Corey.
All right. Stand with your back against the tree. You, Corey, stand next to him.
The men obeyed. Keeping her eyes on them while they eyed her blade, she took the end of the chain and circled the tree several times. There was a lock at one end. She drew the two ends together and locked the chain. Then she stepped out in front of them.
I'm going for help now. If your help arrives before mine, my father is not to be chained. His wound is to be cared for and he is to be rested and fed. If this is not done, your king and your Melba will answer to the round ear of prophecy himself.
Corey and Bemode looked at each other. Bemode swallowed. They might disagree, but they were not in a position to argue.
And one other thing.
Her glove struck the sword point down into the ground.
When my father revives, he will want his sword. Take good care of it. It's a gift from your king.
You fly-blown idiot! You had to tell her to bring the sword!
Well, if you hadn't been so busy looking up her dress, you'd have told me not to!
John Knight lay on the straw-filled mattress and watched as Goethe, his flop-ear attendant, ladled his soup. Miraculously, his injured hand and broken finger had healed perfectly, as though treated by Earth's best surgeons. Goethe handed him the beautifully wrought silver bowl and exquisitely designed spoon. He took them, marveling again at how well his hand worked. He also admired the moving picture on the bowl. When the spoon approached it, the face on the bowl smiled. This seemed to be an actual change in the image, not a mere illusion. What phenomenal artisans these folk were.
You want bread?
Thank you, Goethe. Yes, please.
He watched across the room, its walls of unbroken stone, its interior that of a neat, clean cottage. She sawed him a hunk of bread from a loaf using a large-toothed knife with a decorated handle.
Goethe, would you bring me the knife?
She brought it, handing it trustingly to him, along with a thick piece of bread. The handle of the knife was in the form of a silver serpent, the tail expanding into the blade. When he touched the end of the handle, the eyes of the serpent moved to follow his motion. He knew this was just the magic of the sculpture, but it was eerie.
You call yourselves the serpent people, Goethe?
That is true, John Knight.
He dipped the bread in the soup and sucked at it.
You know, Goethe, I'm nearly well now.
Yes, yes. Your mind and body both healed.
Mind?
You were mad.
Had he been? He thought back. Images came to him erratically. Could he make any sense of them? Maybe if he tried to put them into chronological order. Falling into the flaw, down, down eternally. Then, somehow he wasn't falling. He was floating in a sea of stars, drifting without direction, without orientation. How foolish to travel through this maelstrom without a map. So he had conjured a map, or dreamed it up, and scratched a route on it, a route to Muvar, that made so little sense, even in his madness, that he had laughed, and laughed, but nevertheless moved along that marked route, which now was a glowing band in the void ahead. The band became a stream of light, or of darkness, and a current carried him along, until it became too swift, and he spun out, or fainted, or dropped into another level of madness. Crawling up a slippery bank, realizing suddenly that it was actually the muddy shell of a turtle as large as the Galapagos kind, or larger, but not the tortoise on which the world was supported. Wrong mythology, maybe. Running, falling, again hurting his sickeningly injured right hand. That hand was mangled horribly, dripping blood, sending pain messages in increasing waves. Trees, brush, rocks, run, 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 falling, 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 pain. Something silver, long. A rope? He reached out his left hand, his working hand. Jaws of a serpent opening wide, a drop of clear venom hanging on a fang and then dropping. Pain, pain, pain. Now a flower gently tapping the head of the serpent. A blue and pink blossom resembling a cross between a violet and a wild rose. A stubby-fingered hand holding the stem. The serpent's jaw closing. The serpent settling down, sliding away. Now a face above the hand holding the blossom. Very blue eyes and very large ears, like a puppy's, Goethe's. She looking down at him, a tear running down her face. He shook himself mentally. It had been so dreamlike, and yet so real. It was much more than a hallucination, or else hallucination could return in memory with entirely too much reality. This was really Goethe. This room that was lighted by large phosphorescent toadstools placed all about. Walls that were rock, and apparently solid rock. It was like a room in a cave or cavern. But the walls were smooth. Laser construction here? Or magic?
You wish to eat?
Please.
She brought him a robe. It was white and smooth and shiny, and on Earth he would have known it as satin. There were underdrawers of a less shiny material resembling cotton. He hesitated, a holdover from his Earth life when the sexes were cautious about naked exposure, and rolled out of bed and quickly donned the garments.
I haven't been up before, have I, Gerda?
Yes, you have. With me walking you?
I don't remember.
No, the healing clouds as it soothes and rebuilds the mind.
He thought about that, and he also thought of how very capable he felt on his feet. Gerda handed him a pair of soft slippers with curled toes. He put them on and looked around the room and spotted a door. He was certain he had looked at it for hours on end, but now it was like seeing it for the first time. It, too, had decorated silver panels that changed in their own fashion, in their own time.
I'll take you to the workplace, John. You're now quite well. The magic has finished its work.
They went under stone archways, through some rooms without windows, and finally came out in a large natural amphitheater. Here there were many flop-eared men wearing pointed caps, not unlike Rudd stockle caps, and leather aprons. They were working at individual anvils. The cauldron around which the work centered contained silver in the molten state. As he watched, one of the flop-ears walked to the cauldron carrying an armload of silvery, scaly, patterned skin. He turned the skin around in his hands and tossed it into the cauldron. Another flop-ear on a scaffold stirred the cauldron with a long ladle.
God, my God!
The skin was serpent skin and was purest silver. Shades of dragons with golden scales. Was there nothing that couldn't be in different existences? A flop-ear, who had been going from anvil to anvil, checking the work, came up to them. He was no taller than Gerda, but his head was larger, and he had the facial expression of a harried foreman.
He healed Gerda.
Yes, healed.
Good. He will trade well.
I don't like to think of that harlot.
No matter. You know the way.
Yes.
Trade? Me? To others like yourselves?
To others like yourself, John.
Like me? People like me, but with pointed ears?
Ears pointed? No, John. Ears like ears on you mortal folk. Tiny ears low on the sides of your head.
John thought of this as they left the workplace and ambled back the way they had come. On the return, he saw that there were many cottages, but that the rooms he had been in were in fact inside a cliff. There were other doors in the cliff, and some round holes that might have been bored by lasers.
What will happen to me, Gerda? Will I be a slave?
I don't know, John. The round ears have their way and we have ours. Their king of Hood buys all mortals who are prisoners of flop ears if they're healthy. They trade for their own kind. What they do with them, I do not know.
Kyan tried to concentrate on other things than their punishment. He had discovered that he could think for himself without Lani knowing his thoughts. But if he thought it in terms of speaking, she knew them immediately. This was nice to know if they were going to be spending an eternity together. But would they? Would their thoughts and those of the serpent gradually merge, becoming one? Maybe that was what would eventually happen. But maybe it could be slowed, if not stopped. What he had to do, he felt, was concentrate on thinking thoughts that were human, that might enable them to merge while retaining human nature and intellect instead of descending to serpent level. John Knight, his father, had talked about were-animals once. He said it was all superstition and invention, but that some people believed in them. On Earth, anything might be possible. Wolves and cats and other Earth creatures holding the spirits of humans and changing with them from time to time. Perhaps these stories owed their existence to being like the flop ears. If spirits could exist, and he was inclined now to believe that they might, then why couldn't there be two apparent species that shared the same spirits? If the serpents were truly immortal ancestors of the flop-ears, then was it strange that the...
Kyan?
Yes, Alani?
Kyan, do you think we can ever return, be in our own bodies again?
Of course! What a question!
I'm afraid, Kyan. I just want to taste the silver and feel our body working.
Not our body, Lani. Get that out of your head. You're human, not serpent. You're a beautiful girl.
Am I, Kyan? Do you really think that?
Of course it's true. Of course. I'm going to marry someone who looks just like you. I'm going to return.
You really think so, Kyan?
Yes. We're both going to return.
I mean, That I'm beautiful?
Yes. Yes, I told you.
You really mean it?
Of course.
You find me beautiful, and you would like to hold me and kiss me and...
I didn't say that.
But it's true, isn't it?
Yes, but...
You will marry this other girl?
I have to, Lonnie. I can't marry you. I'm from another frame. That just wouldn't be right.
Not right?
My father came to our frame from another, and...
Kyan, I love you.
I love you, Lonnie.
I want to do those things with you, to hold you and kiss you and...
No!
And make love to you, and you feel the same.
We have no bodies.
Oh, Kyan.
Oh, Lonnie, I did not mean to...
I think we can do it now, Kyan. Let me try.
Now? But...
Then he felt her kiss on his lips. He might not have a mouth, but he had the awareness of his human anatomy, and so did she. And it was certainly a kiss.
We shouldn't...
She embraced him. Her spirit within the serpent interacted with his, and the sensation was exactly like a physical embrace, only more so. Because there was nothing to get in the way.
Oh, Lonnie. Lonnie!
Kyan! Kyan!
They no longer fought it. They came together more intimately than either had imagined possible, and... With motion, daylight broke into their functioning eye. Jolted out of their incipient emergence, they raised their silver head to the setting sun and breathed in through their nostrils and the air passages covered by their scales. They undulated, crawled, and wriggled out of the rock tunnel they had made. Boys with big floppy ears were there for them. They shivered all their length, anticipating gentle touches, the soothing strokes, the exhilarating yet calming scent. The boys held out their blossoms and touched their nostrils with the pink and blue flowers. They sucked in the scent with great waves. It filled their being, taking away all doubt and hope and questions. Taking away, finally, all sense of duality and of self. They were one with the serpent. Jack hesitated outside the tent flap, dreading to go inside. Steeling himself for an unpleasant sight, he pushed on into the tent. The sight that met his eyes was shocking, even to him. The lovely, recently intended sacrifice was stretched out by the body of the stranger, and both were apparently dead. She had joined him in suicide.
Master, I could not stop her. She took the berries. She followed him.
When did she...
This morning, Master. Just after you left.
We'd better...
Master, I do not believe that they are dead.
They're not breathing. Have they any heartbeats?
No breathing, no heartbeats. But also no stink and no bugs.
But I'm not sure that means anything, Hito.
I've touched them, Master. I have taken their hands. It's strange, Master, but I felt something besides their cold flesh. I was floating, Master, or felt I was floating, though I did not leave this tent. I was somewhere dark. There were rocks about and dirt, and I could feel them the length of my body. It was not her body, and it was not his. It was a serpent's.
A serpent's?
Yes, Master. I waited to tell you. I thought that perhaps...
Yes, I want to try.
That is not what I mean, Master. I thought that perhaps you would know.
I know only what the stranger Kyan told me, but if a serpent has them, has their spirits...
Is that possible, Master?
I don't know.
Jack sat down by the dwarf, took a good grip on his feelings, and reached for Lonnie's hands. They were cold, but there was no stiffness. Proof, perhaps, that this was not actually death. He gripped the hands and closed his eyes.
Is this the way you did it, Hito?
Yes, Master, but that was this morning. I had not the courage to try it again. Perhaps it will not work now. Perhaps I only imagined it.
No, something's happening. I sense black and roughness and... a taste.
A taste, Master?
Ah, dirt! Ah, bah, puh. Now, Now a more peppery taste. Silver! Silver ore! She likes it, he doesn't. They're inside it. Inside the serpent.
I told you, Master.
Now I'm seeing something through an eye. One eye, the serpent's eye.
Only one eye, Master?
Yes, only one. Now she and he are talking. Talking in the serpent. I don't know the words. I don't know what they're saying, but they seem to be...
Oh, they're attracted to each other.
They're kissing and embracing and...
And they seem to be merging.
Mingling as one mind. It's like sex, only so strange. And
now, oh, light. Outside, ground. Boys with flowers extending them towards the eye. The flowers touch the nostrils. It breathes it in and...
He pulled himself away, dropping her hands. It was an experience he had never imagined.
Are you all right, Master?
I think it's digesting them.
Then they will die?
I think they must. And he too, this is mad, but I think the one-eyed serpent is the one he killed.
Killed, Master? With your spear? In the eye socket?
That's the one, the very one, I'd swear to it. We can't bury them, Hito. Until
morning?
Until we have to. Until we know that they are gone for good and there is only the serpent left.
Master, that's so sad.
Very sad, Hito, very, very sad. We will leave the bodies in the tent for as long as we can. For now, we'd better sleep outside.
There's nothing we can do, Master? Nothing to save them?
Nothing I know of.
The next day at dawn, Jack moved quietly about the camp so as not to awaken anyone. He got his best and biggest spear and tiptoed with it to his horse. He saddled and bridled the mare and rubbed her muzzle. He fastened the spear to the saddle with his best rope and walked the mare until they were clear of the camp. He hiked up his sword, mounted, and rode at an easy walk. He had gone only a short distance when he heard the other horse. Turning around, he was quite surprised to see Hito riding after him. He waited. The dwarf pulled up.
Master, I want to go with you. I brought this.
Hito held up the weapon Kyan Knight had brought with him from another world, lost and then found again. The worthless weapon to its former owner, though he had not relinquished it. A Muvar weapon was still a Muvar weapon.
What good do you think that will be?
I don't know, Master. I just brought it.
Do you know that I do not expect to return?
If you do not, I will not.
They rode on for Serpent Valley and its great curve of surrounding cliffs. There were holes in the cliffside that he had seen before, some large, some small, many in between. The mist was still heavy as they approached. Jack kept glancing back at Hito adjusting his spear. Jack motioned for Hito to follow him and rode his horse into one of the smaller holes facing the larger one. There was a stir of darkness within the larger hole, and the serpent's head appeared. As he started and stared at it, he saw that one eye was damaged. He could still see the wounds the spearhead had made. Not giving himself a chance to think, he spurred his horse and charged with spear poised to stab into that remaining orb. The serpent's head came up. The eye, that single strange eye, bored at him. In that dark mirror, he saw her face, and on the instant of that seeing, he was paralyzed. The serpent wriggled out of its tunnel, its great mouth opened. Jack saw but could not comprehend what was happening. He was frozen in place, unwilling to move or to think of moving. His mare, being but mortal, was in similar shape. Hito saw his master ride out with raised spear. He saw the serpent's head rise up, though the mist fogged the details. He saw the horse stop. Both horse and rider were motionless. Both awaited death. He saw death emerge from the hole in front of them as the serpent drew the rest of its body out and made ready to strike. They did not move. It must not happen. He had to help. Hardly thinking what he did, Hito pulled out the weapon from another world and raised it until it pointed over Master's head at the gigantic head of the serpent. He pressed the trigger on the weapon as if it would accomplish anything. Bright light filled the tunnel and splashed outside. His fingers loosened on the weapon. It slid from his hand and dropped to the ground. Hito took up the horse's reins. In the mists that were rapidly dissipating, he could see both master and horse and the motionless form of the serpent. He rode out, hardly thinking, blinking his eyes against the mist. The serpent remained frozen in striking position. It seemed almost a statue of itself. His master suddenly jerked, and his horse jumped, almost throwing him.
Master! Master! Kill it!
His master got the mare controlled, raised the spear to the eye, and looked directly into the eye.
She's not there, Hito! I can't see her now. She's gone back to camp.
Master?
I don't know what's happened. It's not moving. Maybe it's dead.
Let's get out of here, Master. Now, while there's a chance.
Master's mouth worked as if his jaws were still partially paralyzed. Finally, he nodded, and together they took off at as great a speed as their mounts could carry them. Kayan opened his eyes and stretched. Above him hung the familiar roof of the tent. Under him, the beaver hide. He turned his head to the right, expecting to see Jack, and instead saw Lani's lifeless form. Even as he sat up, her breathing started and her color returned. She stared at him, then sat up as abruptly as he had.
Kayan! Kayan, we...
He thought rapidly, trying to deny it to himself, wishing despite himself that it could be true, yet knowing it was not.
It must have been an illusion that we were together. How could we be alive without bodies and a serpent? But even if it wasn't a dream, it hardly matters. It wasn't as though we were lying here joined. Astral bodies are like bodies we dream. Whatever they are, they don't count.
Don't they?
No, not really. But what happened? The last I remember, we were together in the serpent.
I remember after that. I remember seeing Jack. He was on his horse and he had a spear and then there was a light.
I remember the light. Jack must have come for us and slain the serpent. Re-slain it, I guess.
Yes. Oh, Kayan, I hate for it to be dead.
So do I.
For he had seen an entirely different side of the monster, and not an evil side. The serpent, he realized, had been brought back to life by the presence of their spirits, and, perhaps, could not survive without them. They were almost to the barrens when Jack felt his head fully clear.
The white light. What was it, and how did it happen?
Oh, Master, I forgot it. It worked, Master. I'm sure it worked. Only I'm not sure what it did or why. I pointed it. I pressed the trigger, and then there was the light.
Lord, the Muvar weapon. Where is it now?
Where we were, Master. At the cliffs, inside the tunnel.
Lord, it had to have been that. Because after that flash, the serpent changed. We're going to have to get it. It could be the answer to everything. If it works, we may have the answer to Flopears and Roforth.
We can't go back now, Master. The sun is up.
Yes, it is, isn't it? If we go back now, they'll get us. So we won't do it now. We'll do it as soon as we safely can.
They rode on toward the camp, following their faint trail through the barrens. A trail that stretched as familiar to both as though marked with signs, but anyone else would not find it. When they arrived, they found confirmation. Kayan and Lani in front of his tent, standing hand in hand, alive. There went, perhaps, his last hope to win Lani. But somehow the pain was less now. He was glad to have her alive, and a new horizon opened on his activity. Even as Jack hailed them, he was already making plans for the recovery of the weapon that worked so strangely to rescue them. Jack drew lines in the sand with a stick and motioned everyone around. It was battle plan time, and all his men, all 56, including Hito, and, of course, the newcomers, Kayan and Lani, grouped outside his tent.
We have to do it this way. Right here on the main road where you lost your way, Kayan. We'll hide behind the trees and wait. Smith, you're the best crossbowman, so we'll station you in a tree where you can take out the leader. Take the leader out as soon as they offer resistance, and we may have a chance. If the flop ears don't get to us first.
I can't be certain this is the route they will take. I only know what I heard in the palace. By the way, that was my last dragonberry. If we don't win, and you haven't got dragonberries growing here, that's the end of Astraline.
Yes, you're right. It's our only chance. Then, when the fighting is heaviest, and there'll be fighting, make up your mind to it. Maybe Hito and I can get back to that tunnel and get back to your move our weapon.
Are you sure it will do any good if we have it?
We'll see. And, Lani.
Yes?
We'll station you on high ground overlooking the valley. If you spot any flop ears, you warn us.
Will my voice carry that far?
No, you'll have to run back. If you shout from the high rock on this spot above the road, we'll hear.
I won't have a horse?
Can't spare one. It all depends on your legs. It's a distance of about twice around this camp.
My legs are good. I'll look out for flop ears.
It's too bad there's not another good spot for an ambush. But then maybe the soldiers won't think to ride for flop ear help. Maybe the flop ears wouldn't help. There's a chance.
Matt Biscuit moved through the men until he was beside Jack.
You'd better use Kayan. Him and his gauntlets.
Right. Kayan, you'll be in the forefront of the charge. Assuming there is a charge, and there's sure to be one. Roforth's men won't give up your father without a fight. So you and I and Biscuit here will be at the head of any charge. Biscuit's good with a sword. I'm good, and from what you say, your gauntlets will make you better.
I really haven't had the practice.
You want me to wear your gauntlets?
No, I'll wear them, and I'm good. I wore them in one battle back in my home frame, and there was only one other warrior my equal.
Then it's settled. We know from your last reconnaissance that they'll be coming at dawn. On their way home, we'll stop them and take away your father. If we do, we have your word you'll help us fight against Roforth and the flop ears. That right, knight?
You know it is.
When he got a good look at the soldiers through his physical eyes, Kayan marveled at how little he had noticed with his astral vision. They were ordinary men, by Jack's reckoning, but they were obviously top fighting men. Sturdy, strong, well-disciplined, and their quality showed. Jack rode out of the trees and raised his hand.
We want your prisoner! Resistance or a refusal to turn him over means death!
By the gods, we'll have none of it! Shields ready! Prepare!
A lucky crossbow bolt from Smith found its target. The captain clutched at the feathered barb piercing his throat above the mail.
Charge!
Kayan hardly had time for it to register before he was charging the foremost men. In a moment more, he was crossing swords, cutting down, stabbing, and chopping expertly. His gauntlets knew and did what was necessary. He saw his father through the dust that now covered everything, and after he had dispatched his fifth man, he felt fully that he was effecting a rescue.
Flop ears! Flop ears!
It was Lani calling from the rock. If it weren't for the dust, he could have bent back, looked up, and seen her. The battle had hardly started, but she was there, calling down to them. Faster than he would have believed possible, the fighting tide turned. Kayan found his gauntlets taking complete control of his hands and arms and almost his mind. Then he was flying from the saddle over his neck. Somehow the gauntlets flung sword and shield and forced his body into an acrobatic roll. He bounced to his feet.
We have to retreat! Quick, before the flop ears arrive!
Thinking only that he must get Lani, Kayan scrambled up the hillside, out of the lake of dust. Now he was at the crest of the hill, coming up by the rock. Lani was on the rock, her eyes fixed glassily on a flop ear, advancing on her with raised club. He could not make it in time. The remaining distance was too great. But even as he realized this, his right glove whipped his sword down, slicing at the ground broadside. The point caught a stone and drove it out and up in what his father called a golf drive. The little stone sailed across and flew at the flop ear's face. Then, as if its job were done, the gauntlet sheathed the sword. The flop ear, no slouch, saw the missile coming and ducked, and the stone missed, but this distracted him from the girl. He looked across and saw the new enemy cresting the hill. The flop ear reoriented, bracing himself and taking a defensive posture with the club. Then, satisfied that he faced only one new enemy, he lifted the club for a smash. Kyan's gauntlets got him to the top and on his feet and his shield up in front of his face before the flop ear could fully turn and redirect his blow. Kyan lurched on his feet as the club smashed against the shield. Then his right glove jumped forward to catch at the flop ear's left knee, and his left glove shoved the shield back hard against the club and the attacker's face. The flop ear lost his footing at the edge of the steeper slope and fell down, rolling over on the slope, tumbling head over boots. Other flop ears would arrive momentarily. Kyan had dealt with one, thanks again to the genius of the gauntlets, but there was no reason to think he could handle three or four.
Come!
Kyan ran, hauling Lani along, his gauntlets helping him decide the route. But Lani tried to hang back.
Kyan, we're going the wrong way! The serpents!
With shock, he realized that his hands were urging them past a pole holding a serpent skin chime. Turning his head, he could just barely see short-legged flop ears toiling up the hillside. And ahead, was the bigger of the two valleys, the one Lani's people called Serpent Valley. Unhesitatingly, the powerful gauntlets pulled them on down the steep hillside where silver serpents lay basking lazily in the morning sun. John Knight could hardly believe that they had arrived, but they had, and they looked just like the troops back home that Ruford had maintained. Only here, it was Roforth, and if he didn't misinterpret Goethe's expression when she talked of him, he was not the ideal monarch for this familiar yet strange fairy tale land.
I'm sorry you go, John. You good man. Not like most mortals.
Blinking in the sunlight, John considered the good, manly uprightness of the troops, the neatness of their green uniforms, and the shine of their highly polished mail.
Goodbye, Goethe.
He mounted. The procession rode out. Turning, looking back, John marveled anew at the cottages and the round holes that had been turned into dwellings and buildings in the surrounding cliff. He breathed in, savoring the delightful green smells of spring. It was spring here, he'd bet. You could mistake a lot of things, but you couldn't mistake the feel of seasons, not when you're outside in a part of the natural scene. They were leaving the valley now by a road he didn't recall, but must once have traveled. He could see that it was a valley, and that there was another valley connecting it. The hills, the mountains, were much like those in Rudd. In a way, it was like some areas of the Americas, if they had not been ground down by glaciers. But if there had been no glaciers here, should there be such valleys? Pondering this, he tried to clear his mind. He was no geologist, so his conjectures were hardly definitive. Whatever made the valleys in these mountains, they ran big, and whatever made the mountains, they ran rough. Now, as in other things, he wished he were more the expert on the subject. Ahead lay wilds, trees and brush. He supposed he had run, crawled, or somehow moved through these parts, yet he could hardly remember. The magic medicine Goethe used on him dimmed any memories of what otherwise might come back. It was plain he got here from the river, and he must have traveled this road. More, he simply could not evoke. They were stopping.
We want your prisoner! Resistance or a refusal to turn him over means death!
By the gods, we'll have none of it! Shields ready! Prepare!
Then the captain was falling, clutching at his throat. Horses neighed and danced. Swords leapt from scabbards. Shields rose. In a moment, a full-scale battle erupted. Briefly, he glimpsed the face of a man not wearing a uniform. A young, now very grim face.
Kyan! Kyan, my son!
Kyan must have followed him to this frame. But who were these men he was with? Who were these rough, ill-clad, undisciplined folk? They looked like bandits from the Sadlands. He dug his heels into his horse's sides and crouched low on the neck, trying to make a break. The horse leaped forward as it was supposed to do, and as he took off, he shoved the soldiers on either side of him from their mounts, or tried to. His outflung arms did not accomplish much. Then he was past, and there were other matters at hand. The man he had thought to be Kayan was in that battle ahead. John didn't have a sword himself or any kind of weapon. Still, the blow took him from behind and sent him out of the saddle and down to the dust. The next thing he knew, someone was pulling him up by his arms. Who had him and why? He did not know. It was all he could do to hang on to his dwindling consciousness. Kayan felt her stiffen and the gauntlet jerked. He knew she had been pierced by the gaze of a serpent or a flop ear. He felt himself swing around, pulled by the left gauntlet, and the jarring thud as shield struck hard against a flop ear's face. The flop ear went down in a heap, his raised club flying from his hands. Kayan gave Lani a quick slap and saw her eyes unglaze. He could hear more flop ears coming in the distance. They had to hide. There was no fighting these flop ears. If they didn't get out of sight, they were going to be killed or captured. A hole showed there in the rocks. A cave? A den? What did it matter? It was a hiding place. He jerked Lani the distance and pushed her ahead of him into the darkness of the hole.
Kayan? Kayan?
Not now, Lani.
Kayan, I love you, Kayan. There's something you should know.
He was afraid he already knew it. That mergence in the serpent. That hadn't been just because they were both captive. It had been because they both wanted it. They both wanted it now. His arms found her and held her. He could feel her heart beating under her light shirt. In a moment, except for the danger, he might forget himself.
Kayan, we're about to die.
Maybe not. I've still got my sword and my shield in the gauntlets. Even if they find us, they can't make eye contact in the dark. I can defend this cave for a long time.
Kayan, this isn't a cave. This is the tunnel a big serpent makes.
If we retreat far enough back...
But Kayan, we can't know what's here. There might be a...
There might not. Not all the holes are occupied. Come!
He led her stumbling and cringing through the blackness. There was no indication, but he felt that the tunnel was old. If it hadn't been used for a long time, just maybe they might follow it to a spot where the original tunneler resurfaced. It was a possibility, though remote. After all, the one they had been in ate silver, then returned to the surface. They did like to sun themselves after a meal.
Kayan, is that a glow?
He paused. He had thought it wishful thinking, but yes, there was a lightness. Outdoors. They'd survive after all. But no, he felt no breeze, no hint of fresh air. His nose, in fact, seemed clogged with dust. So if that wasn't daylight, what was it? There were no alternatives but to go on. His gauntlets tugged at him, forcing him to move away from the wall and follow their lead, lest he be drawn off balance. His light shone greenish. That meant luminous moss on rock walls. There was a blaze of green light, and then he stopped, grabbing Lani's arm. They were right in the exiting mouth of a serpent tunnel that led from a wide natural chamber. Luminous lichen coated the chamber's walls. Other serpent tunnels, not of this size, also entered it at irregular intervals.
Maybe we can find a way out by taking another tunnel.
Yes, Kayan. Oh, yes.
Holding Lani's hand in his, feeling awed by the size of the chamber, he led her into it. There were outcroppings of rock and stalactites of great size above them, stalagmites rising up like raised spears from the floor. In the green radiance, all shone clear for a surprising distance. It was as though they had entered some mammoth building. There was little dust, and fresh air circulated through serpent holes far overhead. Lani's face held the same awe Kayan felt. The place stretched as far as they could see, and there seemed no end to the radiance. Even if one of the serpent tunnels presented an immediate exit, the impulse to explore grew overwhelming. They walked hand in hand, admiring the beauty. Fear diminished. Fear could not flourish in loveliness like this. Silver ore outcroppings here and there, like rivers and streams of shining mineral, flowed frozenly through the rock. A crystal waterfall plunged, greenish and sparkling, from as high a source as any waterfall Kayan had ever seen.
Oh, Kayan! Oh, it's as pretty as the flappier silver work!
They walked between the stalagmites and found themselves in a narrow chamber. Ahead, silver. Lots of silver. He stopped, staring. The silver lay in long, thin belts made of overlapping scales. Serpent skins, many of them from giants.
Gods, Lonnie, there's a fortune. They must have been coming here for ages. If only Jack and his men could come down here, they'd never have to steal silver from the Flopears again. They'd be rich as any king. They could go out and buy themselves an army or a kingdom.
Kyan?
It's all right.
Kyan, remember where we are.
Then, silver appeared in one of the serpent tunnels. They stood frozen as a great serpent snout, larger even than the one they had been in, protruded from one of the holes. That could be why the tunnel they had entered was empty. It was too small for a serpent this size. It did not see them, and Kyan pulled Lonnie away back into a natural alcove. It was as though the cavern walls had come alive. Serpents of great and simply large size, serpents the size of ordinary snakes, and serpents the size of worms, squirming out of open tunnels and tunneling themselves out of rock. Bits of rock dust fell here and there as serpents broke free of the honeycombed rock.
Oh, Kyan, Kyan, hold me! Hold me before it's too late!
Any moment, a head might emerge at their backs. Any moment, a serpent might set its freezing eyes on them. After a time, he found her face turned to his. Silently, sweetly, he kissed her. Perhaps they would soon die horribly, but at the moment, they were wonderfully alive. Herzig came as fast as his short legs could carry him. The Flopear motioned to the body on the ground. He pulled up by it and looked down.
Tanzar!
His club lay near his hand, but there was a bruise on his forehead.
Herzig, do you think they have a way of deflecting the serpent eye?
Khazar bent over Danzar, his stubby fingers lifting his eyelids to reveal the whites.
With a bruise like that? No. If they could resist the eye, they would have taken him with them. Look here in the dirt. Tracks of two mortals.
Then Danzar got careless?
Yes. Never underestimate a mortal. They are stupid, but some are less stupid than others.
Like Roforth?
Roforth, their king of Hod, is too cruel to be entirely stupid. Not stupid, but not wise, and not what mortals call good.
No!
Danzar looked out again through his eyes.
Two mortals, a man and a woman. I thought to club the woman dead, but he threw a stone to distract me, and then swung without looking at me.
He swung without looking?
Oh, yes, his shield. He swung round fast, and the shield caught me so fast I didn't see it. And my knee, oh, he grabbed my knee so that I fell. I never expected such coordination when I thought him done for.
Khazar pointed to an opening in the rocks. It was an old ancestor tunnel rather than a natural opening. A pair of footprints shone clearly in the dust in the tunnel's opening.
Should we go after them, Herzig?
Why? You know what will happen to them.
But should it? These mortals, a part of our ancestors joining in the cycle.
The cycle has seasons. We are none of us but ourselves, and yet making up ourselves are all our past ancestors. Mortals are the same way but don't realize it. On the next cycle it won't matter. Do you ever wake to remember tunneling, Khazar? No, nor do I. The lives of ancient serpents are not a part of our daily existence.
I've heard it before all my life, but I have to be reminded.
We're none of us dirt, Khazar, and all of us are dirt. Mortals as well as serpent people.
Yes, that is true.
What do you want to do about those mortals? Now that you've been reminded of what they are and what we are and of the endless cycle governing all.
Khazar walked to the tunnel's opening.
Mortals! We're coming to get you, mortals! Run! Hide! Run until your hearts burst! We're coming, mortals! We are coming!
Hito watched from concealment in the rocks as the Flopears left the vicinity of the tunnel. He had watched as Kyan and Lonnie ran into the tunnel to hide, and he had seen the three Flopears talking and now leaving. They would be back, he thought, with help.
Hito!
Hito turned to see Jack on his mare. Jack had ridden up behind him, knowing where he was, coming to him by way of the cutoff route that few actually knew about.
Hito, we're not winning. Too many Flopears joined the soldiers. We can't get John Knight from them. We can't slip into Serpent Valley and get the weapon. We're beaten, Hito, beaten.
Master, Kyan and Lonnie are in that tunnel. Three Flopears have just left.
And they're as good as dead.
Kyan knocked the flop ear down with his shield, Master. Then the two others came. The two who did not see them. But I know they are there.
Good man, that Kyan. Young, but good. It was the gauntlets that did it, of course. They did the fighting, and they struck the flop ear.
I know.
The flop ear was caught because he thought he was fighting a man. Had he known he was fighting magic, it might have been different.
That must be. But the serpents, the gauntlets can't overcome them. Not down in their own realm.
Come.
Reluctantly, Hito let his master take his hand and lift him up onto the front of the horse. The horse walked at a slow pace back the way it had come. Soon they came out of the brush. Dead and dying men lay everywhere. Some stone as statues, frozen in place by some absent flop-ear stare.
Matt! Start rounding up the survivors. We're going back to the Barrens.
We lost, didn't we? All because we trusted that foreigner. Him and his magic gauntlets and his hero father and brother. I knew it was a mistake.
We had to try. Now at least we know Rofirth can enlist flop-ear help. Knowing that, we know what we're up against and who we fight.
We? How many do you think you have left? Maybe 20 men, and half of them wounded. You think you'll take over a kingdom with that?
But the master simply kept riding, acting as if he saw no death and hadn't heard a word of biscuits. Kyan drew Lani back behind a rock outcropping and dared not peek out at the serpents. Lani trembled within his embrace. Neither of them dared make a sound. Yet eventually, one of those sliding silver bodies would come close and discover them. Then, his theory about their safety would be tested, and he had little faith in it. After all, even if a serpent wasn't interested in hunting at the moment, it would hardly pass up a couple of succulent morsels that turned up right under its nose. They could only get away. But how? Feeling behind him in the dark, Kyan felt no wall. Maybe a passage lay behind them. A way to escape? He tugged Lani in that direction, his gauntlets helping him. He had to trust the gauntlets. Their guess was at least as good as his. They moved in terrible blackness. There was no phosphorescence here. He felt as if he were walking into a wall of black velvet, almost feeling the physical touch of the darkness. Then, ahead, greenish radiance. Was it the cavern they had left? Did this winding tunnel simply double back to where they had been? That did not make much sense to him, but his opinion didn't count. What counted was what made sense to the serpents. The persistent gauntlet seemed to slow, perhaps not quite certain, but they did not stop. Gradually, the radiance grew stronger as they emerged from the total darkness. Suddenly, there was a big gap in the floor. It cut off the tunnel, and beyond it, a blank wall. The other side of this vault had slid along, taking the rest of the tunnel with it. That must be why there were no serpents here. Even they did not care to navigate a discontinuity of this size. It would be easier to use an unspoiled tunnel. Or perhaps they had re-drilled it, only to have the vault slide again. Maybe this was a low silver region, so they didn't bother to maintain the tunnels. The radiance came from the crack. They stopped. Kyan had no idea how to proceed, and Lani seemed as if she would not dare even try to think of an idea. Were the gauntlets in similar doubt? He examined the cleft more carefully. This seemed to be the same type of moss that lined the cavern walls. The rent in the stone was a fracture that might have been caused by a quake or by the movement of a gigantic body. It had sundered the serpent tunnel, cutting it off, making it useless. They might find a number of tunnels spoiled by such cracks. Odd the moss grew so freely here, and not at all in the tunnel. Perhaps there was a better supply of nutrients in the air that passed through here, for there was air. He felt its slight, cool motion along the crevice.
Kyan, what?
Shh! There might be a use for this luxuriant moss if it could be carried. The radiance was an inferior light source, but it did permit a limited vision, and it was far, far better than nothing. He drew out his sword from its scabbard, thinking to scrape off a handful.
Kyan, down there, way down, see it?
He placed his cheek next to hers and strained to see what she saw. There was something. Way, way down the narrow cleft, he could see a softer, lighter glow. It seemed to come from a series of fist-sized knobs.
Glow rooms. Flop ears use them for lighting. They have them in their cottages and carry them like lamps.
I'll get one.
Be careful.
I will. You wait.
Slowly, painfully, on hands and knees, and sometimes on his stomach, he made his way toward the lighter glow. There they were, clustered about another crack from which came more greenish glow. Kyan saw that the crack opened almost directly below him. Another underground river, and this one not of his world. Did this, too, lead to a flaw that went not only through this entire world, but through many? He had used Muvar's machine to come to this frame, but it might be that the rivers crossed between frames, too. Muvar might simply have found a mechanical and reliable way to do what the rivers and the flaw did randomly.
Kyan, can you get it?
Yes!
Cautiously, he cut off the thick toadstools and impaled three of them on his sword blade. Equipped now with a light, he twisted and got his head pointed the right way.
Kyan, I can see you well now. And Kyan, that hole, it goes way down.
I know. There's a river below us. Way below us.
Oh, Kyan.
Better not talk. We can't be certain there's not a serpent about.
But after seeing that eerie river, he had a notion why there were no serpents here. They must have the same awe of the environs of the flaw as he did. The crevice had opened the tunnel to the dark river below, and the serpents did not trust that. Smart serpents. He reached the edge of the moss-coated crack and raised the sword with its light. The tunnel continued ahead of the crack after its jog to the side, he saw now. They had merely to squeeze through and across.
We have to try going on, Lonnie. This tunnel has to come out somewhere. We have breathable air at least.
They got into the next section of the tunnel and soon left the crack behind. Something smelled good. So used to the all-pervading earth smells of an abandoned serpent tunnel, he had difficulty with this concept at first. Then, the origin of the smell came to him, and he realized at the same time that he was starving. Bread.
A bakery? Down there?
Or a cottage. Flop ears used old tunnels for rooms or for cottages.
I know, we were there together.
I wonder how far down the hole goes. If I go down there, I should at least be able to get us some bread.
Kyan, remember what happened when they had us?
But now we have our bodies. Maybe they just turn us over to Roforth.
Roforth? He's worse than a serpent.
Perhaps.
He divested himself of his shield and scabbard and handed her the sword.
You stay here and hold the light. I want to see just where this goes. If we have to just walk away, well, maybe we can.
Kyan, I'm afraid.
He hesitated a moment, and then took off the gauntlets and handed them to her.
You wear these for a while. If I'm not right back, they may have to get you out.
She drew the gauntlets on over her hands.
Why, they fit perfectly. How?
Magic. Just think what you want them to do, and they'll do it for you. Sometimes they do more than you'd think to do yourself.
Be careful, Kyan.
I'll try to be.
He started crawling on his hands and knees. Soon the light disappeared, enveloping him in total darkness. Suddenly, he put his right hand out and brought it down on a point lower than he. The passage now sloped steeply downward. He put his left hand down by his right and slipped. The next thing he knew, he was sliding, sprawled out at full length, trying desperately to stop. He dropped. He fell into a white room and startled Flop-Ear faces. He landed on something solid. He was blind for the moment, his breath knocked out in his face, he realized, down in a lump of dough.
What's that?
A Flop-Ear turned with a pan of bread just as Kyan got dough out of his eyes. He saw four Flop-Ears, flour, and loaves of bread. He flung away bread dough that clung to his face and breathed in the smell of a bakery. He looked around wildly and then saw the frying pan coming down on his head. There was no time to duck, no time to think about it. When he next opened his eyes, painfully, he beheld a familiar face, Goethe's. Lonnie tried to see into the hole, but the light only reached a couple of body lengths. The source of the baking was farther than Kyan had thought, as she feared. It seemed to her that he had been gone a long time. Should she follow? No. If Kyan was captured by Flopears, he'd need help. It seemed unlikely she could get him help, but she'd have to try. He should have kept the gauntlets. Then he'd be all right. But then she wouldn't have them. And without them, she couldn't even think of going for help.
Gauntlets, help me find the way out. Take me to the outdoors, gauntlets.
The gauntlets tugged at her hands. She followed the direction, carrying the sword light in her right hand, the shield in the left. In a surprisingly short time, she found herself running, despite her fatigue, following the pull of the gauntlets. Ahead, shadows danced on the walls, and the outrageous figure danced in a pool of wet. She tried to stop, at least to slow, but the gauntlets made her plunge on. Icy water grabbed at her ankles, splashed up on her legs, and even touched her face. She sped through the pool as though there could be no danger from it, her feet wanting to slow and the gauntlets pulling relentlessly. She stumbled, slipped, and it was as if the gauntlets gave a great yank on her hands and wrists, sending her head down through the water and around a sudden bend. She negotiated the curve in the tunnel in a half-sprawling run that gave out at its limits and deposited her face down on the rock. The sword, with its glow runes, lay stretched ahead at arm's length. She did not touch the blade as the roof of the tunnel fell in. Now she understood why the gauntlets had urged her on so mercilessly. Without them, she would have died. She was buried, but not for long. The remarkable gloves let loose of the shield and sword and moved dirt away from her head and face. She sat up, fumbled for the glow runes, the sword, and shield under the dirt. She stood up, shaking, her eyes tearing, bruised but alive. The broken glow runes on the sword still gave forth their light, though the gauntlet quickly broke them all the way and put the 7 separate pieces on the very tip of the sword. The tunnel behind lay blocked solid with rock and dirt. Her grave, but for the gauntlets.
Kyan! Oh, Kyan, I must get help for you! I must!
The gauntlet gently squeezed her hand and tugged. Now that the immediate danger was over, it would lead her at a more moderate rate. The dust gradually settled as she walked. When she reached a spot where she could actually see the pieces of glow room on the blade, she began to think it over. Up until this point, she had visualized the entire tunnel collapsing. Yet she wasn't out of it yet, and she didn't know if she ever would be. The gauntlets abruptly tugged her to the side. She followed their lead without resistance, and in due course came to a chamber ending in a blank wall.
What?
But the gauntlets drew her down. She felt along the wall and found a hole at the base. She put her face down to peer into it, bringing the sword point close, and got a whiff of bread. The odor wafted through the hole. One gauntlet reached into the hole, caught hold of something, and carefully tugged it out. A loaf of flop-ear bread. This must be a hole in the wall behind a flop-ear kitchen or pantry. She had just raided their food. She stood, carrying the loaf. Now the gauntlets led her to another dark region, where a stream of fresh water flowed. She was thirsty. She put her lips to it and drank. Then she sat down and gnawed into the loaf. The gauntlets had become quiescent, letting her rest and eat so she did not worry about being discovered. What relief to eat at last and to be off her weary feet. She finished the loaf. She ought to get going, but it was so tempting to rest just a little more. The gauntlets would surely have her rushing forth soon enough. She lay on the rock, cradled her head with her arms, and made herself as comfortable as she could. Many hours later, she woke.
Gauntlets, you shouldn't have let me sleep so much. I've got to help Kyan. You know that.
The gauntlets gave a little squeeze on her hands. They seemed apologetic. Maybe they had needed to rest too, after their labors.
I'm sorry, I wasn't thinking of your needs. But maybe now...
Immediately, the gauntlets tugged at her, leading her on, resuming the route they had been following before she ate and slept. They were back in action. She only hoped the delay had not been disastrous for Kyan. There was another serpentine bend. No more water seepage, at least. Every time she went around one of these bends, she wondered whether there'd be a serpent or a pool of water waiting. Or maybe, incredible thought, a small, irregular opening to the outside. She walked around the bend and almost fell. There was a larger tunnel crossing this one as the much smaller tunnel had done. The gauntlets pulled her, not overly roughly or insistently, into the larger serpent tunnel on her left. It was just like a mess of interconnecting roads. This new tunnel appeared to be no more recently used than the other. This entire region seemed to have fallen into disuse by the serpents. She wondered whether she and Kyan could have been through this one before. Probably not. There was too much dust here, and it really hadn't been that long. The serpent's body would certainly have wiped it clean if they had taken this particular route. So, this was more likely some distant place. Ahead. Could it be? A round hole of daylight? Was she hallucinating? She stopped, though her gauntlets didn't direct a halt. The gauntlets tugged at her with a come along now urgency. She decided to trust them. It was then that she saw the object lying on the floor of the tunnel. The incoming daylight made it shine. She blinked, but it remained. Unless Muvar had been down in the tunnels, that was the weapon Hito had left. This had to be that tunnel, which meant that it could be Jack and Hito outside. But if it turned out to be Flop Ears, she had to get that weapon. It could be the means of rescuing Kyan and defeating Roforth. She must not let it fall into the Flop Ears' hands. She crept closer, closer to the daylight. Now if she could just reach out and snatch it back into the dark. A man appeared in the daylight. She waited, hoping to see who it was. She dared not approach, though he was right near the weapon. Maybe he wouldn't see it. The man stooped down to pick up the weapon. As he did, a ray of sunlight lit up his thinnish, tall form, and then his face. It was a man Lani had never seen before.